On the 5th of January, a special Senate runoff election in the deep south state of Georgia will determine the future of Joe Biden's presidency. Will the new president be able to take action on climate change, jobs, racial justice, healthcare, and much more? The voters of Georgia will decide the crucial power balance in the US Senate, and the polls are neck and neck. I'm Mary Fitzgerald, the editor-in-chief of Open Democracy, and I'm reporting from Georgia during the final days of this critical race. Ahead of the trip, I spoke with Andra Gillespie, a political science professor at Emory University in Atlanta, for a documentary podcast. We talked about why this traditionally conservative state is suddenly competitive for the Democrats after Biden became the first Democrat president to win here since 1992, back in November. She and I went on a deep dive into the history of Georgia, its politics, racial divisions, and much more. Here's our extended interview.
So this is not the first time that we've started to see a partisan shift in Georgia. After the Civil War and after the Reconstruction period in particular, the South was almost exclusively Democratic in its orientation. And so we often refer to what we call the solid Democratic South. Democrats were the ones who were proponents of segregation, who rewrote state constitutions to disenfranchise Blacks, the people who were creating the Jim Crow system of segregation in the United States. And there started to be a shift. So the first thing that starts to happen nationally is Franklin Roosevelt took advantage of the Great Depression to create the New Deal, which helped to expand government and presidential power. But he did it by creating this multiracial coalition of Southern Democrats, of Blacks who were living outside of the South and who could vote. And so we see this really sort of interesting tension in Democratic Party politics in the mid-20th century, where on the one hand, the Democrats needed to appeal to African Americans and did so for those who moved over to the Democratic Party because Blacks had been Republicans, because Lincoln was a Republican and he had been responsible for the Emancipation Proclamation and for freeing slaves. They started to move to the Democratic Party because of the economic program that was promised by the New Deal. But after World War II, there started to be moves within the Democratic Party to become more overtly pro-civil rights. And that was going to put racial progressives in conflict with Southern Democrats who largely ruled the party. And so we see some of the first rumblings of this in the 1948 Democratic National Convention, adding civil rights to the platform. This was something that Harry Truman wanted to add. And when he succeeded in doing that, we see a rift in the Democratic Party with South Carolina Governor Strom Thurmond walking out of the convention, creating his own party, the States' Rights Democratic Party, commonly known as the Dixiecrat Party, and running for president against Harry Truman and actually winning four deep Southern states, including his own South Carolina. So after the Dixiecrat Revolt, of 1948, we see Southern Democrats come back into the fold, especially the ones who had, you know, been aligned with Strom Thurmond. And they use their positions of leadership within Congress, for instance, their committee chairmanships, their high-ranking leadership positions within the party caucus, to slow walk civil rights legislation in the 1950s. But by the time we get to the 1960s and the civil rights movement is in its heyday, the Democratic Party can't ignore the onslaught. And so while John F. Kennedy actually tried to walk a fine line and appease all sides in the civil rights debates after his assassination, Lyndon Johnson, a Southerner himself, decides that it's actually sort of a moment of leadership. And he uses his position as a Southerner, his prior role, and his relationships that he cultivated as Senate Majority Leader to help push through a very rigorous and very aggressive civil rights agenda that culminated in the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Fair Housing Act. So with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, one, African Americans are now able to vote in large numbers, and in many places in the South, including places like Georgia, Blacks were by and large disenfranchised. There were always a few who could, but the vast majority of African Americans were discouraged from voting because of literacy tests and other practices of intimidation. And then we started to see the Democratic Party become heavily identified with civil rights and with support for African-American freedom struggles. And this creates this perceptual chasm that persists today. So whereas in the 1950s, you had people who were pushing for civil rights within the Democratic Party, and you had champions for civil rights in the Republican Party, so people like Nelson Rockefeller, for instance. By the time we get to the mid-1960s, the Democratic Party, because of President Johnson's advocacy of civil rights legislation, far and away becomes the perceptual leader in terms of which party is the better party on civil rights. And when that happens, one, we start to see a huge shift in African-American voting behavior. So before the civil rights legislation of the mid-1960s, tracing back to the New Deal, what we saw was that Blacks voted Democratic by about a 2-to-1 margin. And this was largely due to the economic policies. After 1964, what we started to see was that that ratio goes from 2-to-1 to about 9-to-1. And it's in part because President Johnson was pushing the Civil Rights Act, making sure to shepherd it through the legislative process. And his Republican opponent in the 1964 presidential election, Senator Barry Goldwater, opposed the Civil Rights Act on libertarian grounds. And that created a perceptual gulf between the Democratic and the Republican Party on issues related to race, particularly African-American civil rights, that the Republican Party has not been able to overcome since. And so the general rule of thumb that we think about today, there is some fluctuation, is that we expect that Democrats are going to get somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of the Democratic vote. And so if we look at voting behavior in Georgia, what we'll see is that African Americans are overwhelmingly Democratic, and that's been the case for a long period of time. But starting in 1964, and it took a number of years for this to happen, we start to see a shift of former white Democrats in the South towards the Republican Party. So people like Strom Thurmond, who by the mid-1960s is actually a senator from South Carolina, start to change their party identification from Democrat to Republican, and they start voting differently. And it's slow. You know, it starts to happen in national elections, and so we see this slow creep and the slow drift of the Democratic Party, or of Southern whites becoming increasingly more Republican in their voting behavior. And it starts in federal elections, and then it trickles its way down to state and local elections. And so we start to see this trend increasing. You know, you can see a high point, you know, a local high point in the early 1980s with the election of Ronald Reagan. There's a little bit of slippage when Bill Clinton, another Southerner, runs on the Democratic ticket for president in the United States, but the trend has been increasing Republican voting behavior amongst whites in the South. And then we start to see it really come full circle at the state level, especially when we look at partisan control of state legislatures. And so in some states, it happened relatively early. In some states, it's actually been pretty recent. So if we look at Mississippi, for instance, Mississippi didn't change partisan control of its state legislature until the early 2010s. So that's kind of where we are. Georgia's story was that it voted for Jimmy Carter, of course, its native son, in 1976 and 1980, and then it voted for Bill Clinton in 1992. But since 1992, the state hadn't voted Democratic in a presidential election. And then we started to see the shift in terms of state control in the early 2000s. So 2002 is a pretty critical year. That was the year that Sonny Perdue was elected governor of Georgia, the first Republican to be elected governor in the state since Reconstruction. That year, the lower house, the Georgia House of Representatives, switched from Democratic to Republican control. The state Senate followed 4 years after that, in 2006, I believe. There were still statewide office holders who were still Democrats, who were incumbents. And as they stopped running for their current seats, usually to run for other offices, they began to be replaced by Republicans. And so 2010 was the election where all the statewide offices in the state were won by Republicans, because by then all of the incumbents had left their current offices to go run unsuccessfully for other offices. So what we're seeing happen now is Georgia's probably entering another period of heavy contestation and very close election margins. And, you know, it's not for the same reason. So we're not seeing a shift in white voting behavior. Whites are overwhelmingly Republican in the state, though not as Republican as they are in neighboring states, which is actually really important for this story. But what we're seeing is a growth in the non-white population in the state. And so in the 2000s, we saw this increase in the size of the African-American electorate. So it grows to be 30% of registered voters in the state overall by 2008, and it stayed relatively steady since then. And then we've also seen a growth in the Asian American and Hispanic populations in the state. So these are still small populations, but they're fast growing. So the proportion of Asian American and Hispanic voters has doubled in less than 10 years in the state of Georgia. And so if you have a base of 30% African American voters, and then you add 6% Asian American and Hispanic voters, and then you have a small but influential number of white Democrats in the state, right, together, if everybody turns out to vote, you can end up in a position where Democrats are actually able to be competitive and might actually be able to get a majority of votes. That's what we saw happen on November 3rd in the presidential race. And so the question of the runoff is whether or not Democrats are going to be able to replicate that.
So a lot of people I've spoken to say it's a story of two states, right? There's Metro Atlanta and then there's the rest of Georgia. And I wonder if there's something you could add to that picture.
Well, you know, that isn't unusual in many parts of the United States. When we look at lots of states, particularly states that may be Republican overall in their orientation, it's not unusual to have urban population centers that are more Democratic in their leaning. And so, you know, some of the reasons for this are demographic. Cities and their immediate outlying areas, those suburban areas, which is where a lot of the contestation is happening now, tend to be more racially and ethnically diverse. And racial and ethnic minorities in the United States break Democratic, or in the case of African Americans, are very, very strongly Democratic. Urban areas tend to have more professional, highly educated residents. This group is trending more Democratic in its orientation. That hasn't always been the case. In addition, there are people who flock to cities because of the cultural amenities. And so America's cultural elite is largely perceived to be more Democratic in its orientation. You know, so the idea that, you know, the rural areas are conservative and that the urban areas are more liberal is not terribly surprising. What a lot of people are thinking about in the United States now is what's the role of the suburbs? And so the suburbs are more politically contested now and perhaps trending more Democratic than they used to be, in part because suburbs have the populations that are more likely to be Democratic or are trending more Democratic than they used to be. I mean, I think it's really important to note that in a state like Georgia, while college educated white people are less Democratic than their non-college educated counterparts, according to the most recent exit polls, college educated white voters in the state were still more likely to vote Republican. You know, and that's a regional feature, just in terms of most whites in the state are Republicans, college educated or not. So that's still what's going on. But the suburbs look different, in part because there are college-educated white people who are more liberal in their orientation, but these suburbs have become more racially and ethnically diverse. You know, gentrification is a real phenomenon. Wealth disparities are real. And so people that may have once come to cities may not be able to afford to live there, so they'll live in suburban areas, you know, where housing is cheaper. This is suburban Atlanta. It used to be Republican suburban Atlanta, but it's a suburban Atlanta that looks very different than it did 20 years ago.
Thank you. I'd love you to paint the picture a little bit for me about what it's like being where you are right now. I mean, I've been speaking to relatives who are just being bombarded with text messages and phone calls, and they say they're on both sides of the political divide, like exhausted by the onslaught on the airwaves and sick of the whole thing. And so I just love to you to paint that picture of sort of what it's like to be living where you are right now and the sort of the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially interesting to be living it in the pandemic, I think, because you're home more. So there are certain things that I do. I certainly get text messages all the time. In terms of the robocalls, I have a landline and I suspect that I am getting many calls, and you know, but I don't pick them up because I think I know what they are. And so I'm like, thanks, but no thanks. And as soon as we were into the runoff season, my suspicion was that the Democratic Party was going to figure out a way that they could canvass safely. And so I spent the early part of my career studying voter mobilization and turnout. And, you know, I'm a student of Don Green, who was, you know, one of the sort of early people sort of in the modern study of political participation to show that canvassing is by far the best way to increase voter turnout. So even though we're experiencing the surge in COVID cases, I suspect that Democrats were actually going to be pretty loath to leave such a golden opportunity to increase voter turnout on the table. And similarly, if we look at the Republicans, and I think President Trump got as high a turnout as he did because they hadn't neglected canvassing over the course of their campaign. But I suspect that behind the scenes, despite all of the rhetoric about the integrity of the election, about why people shouldn't trust absentee ballots, there are Republicans who are attempting to bank absentee ballots because of the utility, one, of avoiding a mirage, but also because it's the holiday season. And so early voting starts on December 14th in Georgia, right when people are, you know, in the middle of doing their holiday preparations, and the election is right after New Year's, where people could be tired or trying to focus on getting back to a normal routine. It's going to be very, very easy to forget about this election. And so if both sides can bank votes by getting people to put them in the mail while they're going out and doing their holiday errand running, or to just have people go vote at an early voting location before the election while they're out doing, you know, their shopping or their chores, right? You'd rather do that than to have to focus on having to do this massive election day turnout. So I suspect that the turnout operations are going to look very similar. If they don't, whichever one has the weakest election day and overall get off the vote operation is probably going to be the side that loses. I think that Republicans cannot assume that they've got this comfortable numerical advantage in the state that they once did. And so Democrats just don't show up to vote. Like, I think just given the fact that control of the Senate is at stake, given the fact that Democrats are buoyed by the recent presidential election result, you just have to assume that Democrats are going to do everything they can to match and exceed Republican turnout, and that they can credibly do this. So this isn't like 2008, when you had a runoff and you had this huge numerical advantage for Republicans in the state. And then on top of that, you have anemic turnout amongst Democrats in the runoff. These, like, that Georgia doesn't exist right now. The new Georgia, you have to assume a rough parity between Democrats and Republicans.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you, what's going to happen? Like, what if you were going to call it, what would you say? And what I hear you say is, don't assume the Republican numerical advantage and assume that it's either much closer or potentially going to be a surprising result.
So let me handicap this for you. So, you know, in 2008, Barack Obama lost Georgia pretty handily, even though back then he lost by a 7-point margin. You know, people were touting that 7-point margin in 2008 as evidence of increasing competitiveness in the state. And that narrow margin was in fact largely due to the higher African-American turnout, because people were excited to turn out to vote. And so what we saw was that there was a down ballot effect in that race. There was a third party candidate who helped to siphon votes away from Saxby Chambliss, the incumbent Republican senator, but Jim Martin, the Democratic candidate, overperformed relative to what people expected a Democratic candidate to do in the Senate race. And then when we got to the runoff election, lower turnout overall, which everybody should expect and should expect actually to happen in this current race, but the numbers looked more like what we would have expected a Democratic candidate to get in a statewide election. And so that margin was huge. I believe, I'm not looking at my numbers correctly, but if I recall it, I think it's a 16-point margin in 2008. And that probably did reflect what would be the equivalent of a Republican registration advantage. We don't actually have formal party registration in the state, but it wouldn't have been unusual in the 2000s for a Republican to beat a Democrat by a double-digit margin. Republicans haven't won races by double digit margins in the last decade, basically. So 10 years ago, when Nathan Deal ran against Roy Barnes, yes, he did win by about a 10 point margin. But in recent years, we haven't seen those types of margins. So those margins have been getting more narrow over time. And so that suggests that the Democratic efforts to identify and mobilize new voters have actually been yielding fruit. And what it also suggests is that from a parity standpoint, Democrats have been slowly and slowly gaining on Republicans in the state. So, I'm not saying that Democrats have this race in the bag. They don't. But whatever happens, the margin, I suspect, is actually going to be pretty narrow, in part because there are more Democratic voters in the state now. I expect that there's going to be really strong mobilization on both sides. I expect that, given the amount of attention that this race is getting, that mobilization efforts are going to be pretty high. And I think people understand how close the race is. And when you have close races like this, I expect that there's going to be pretty high turnout. I'm not going to hazard a guess as to who's going to win, because the surveys, the polls suggest a statistical tie. I think the other questions that people tend to ask are, do we expect that there's going to be split ticket voting? So could somebody vote for David Perdue in one race and then vote for Raphael Warnock in another race, or Kelly Loeffler and John Ossoff? And, I would say that that's likely. Like, I don't see sort of perfect correlations in the survey data, even though some of that's noisy. But one, Democrats have no incentive to split their ticket. They need both seats in order to get to the 50-50 tie that would be needed in order for Senator, now soon to be Vice President Harris, to be able to be the tie-breaking vote. And we're in an era of hyper-partisanship and polarization. So the idea that somebody would be loyal, a Republican would be loyal to one Republican candidate but not the other, doesn't seem likely. My only sort of caveat or proviso there is that if there is some earth-shattering personal revelation about one of the candidates that comes out in the next few weeks, and I don't think anything that's come out, even, as sort of, hard hitting as some of the attacks has been of the level that would change people's minds about the candidates. So despite all the stories that are coming out about the Republican senator stock trades, or the attacks that have been levied against the Democratic candidates for being radical leftists, I think that their co-partisans are actually, one, very loyal to them, and the ones that are going to show up in this election are highly motivated to vote for, to vote in sort of a package deal, to vote for both Democrats or to vote for both Republicans.
Thank you. Yeah, that seems likely to me as well. And for Democrats, it doesn't matter if they win one, they have to win both.
They have to win both. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is what's happening in Georgia, what's happened and what's happening and what could happen in Georgia, is it and how is it a template for what might happen elsewhere in the South from an organizing perspective?
So I think that there are a lot of things to think about. Like, this story isn't just a story of demographics, nor is it just a story of organization. But if a group is identified with a particular cause or a particular party or a particular slate of candidates that are unpopular in the region, you can do all the mobilization you want. Honestly, if your pool of potential voters is small and not a numeric majority, you probably aren't going to win. Well, what Democrats in Georgia, whether they were doing it in a nonpartisan fashion or whether they were doing it as part of the party apparatus, saw was that there was a growing pool of people who were likely to be receptive to the message. And they noticed it by looking at the census numbers and the demographics in the state. And they weren't just content to be passive and say, oh, well, we see sort of, this growth in the non-white population, we're going to eventually get there. Again, if you don't register these people to vote and then you don't remind them to turn out to vote, then they're not voters. They're just residents of the state. And so I think that that's a really sort of important lesson to learn. But on the other hand, I think the question is, why Georgia, why not Mississippi, or why not Alabama? And demographics do play a really important role in the state. So one, there is racial polarization in terms of party identification and voting across the region. It's more acute in some of our neighboring states than it is in Georgia. And these are all relative kinds of comments, but we're talking about the difference between it being possible for 30% of whites to vote Democratic in Georgia versus that number being closer to 20% in our neighboring states. And then there is the difference of how big the non-white population is. So in general, states like Mississippi, for instance, do actually have proportionally a larger African-American population. And if they're registered to vote at the same rate that Blacks are in Georgia, so that the numbers look proportional, right? If you get 90% of 35% in Mississippi, but 80% of 65% of whites vote Republican, numerically, Republicans still win, right? But in Georgia, if that number of that percentage of whites is who are voting Republican is a little bit lower, and the share of whites who make up the sort of overall electorate is a little bit lower, and then you not only have Blacks who are still 30% of Blacks who are still voting 90% Democratic, but you've got other groups that are voting more Democratic, you can cobble together a 50% plus one coalition. So, you know, the reason why Georgia looks different from Alabama or Mississippi is that there is the making of a multiracial coalition there that doesn't exist in the same way. And so I think just Georgians have to brace themselves for, you know, elections being close, for there being a lot of attention in races and lots of ad buys that, you know, take up our airwaves.
You know, there was the sort of old saying that in Georgia, you have to, and this is obviously shifting, but you need to have nearly 30% of the white vote to win in Georgia. So tell me about why that was perceived to be the case, if it's changing, how it's changing.
So again, so they call it the 30-30 rule. So you need Blacks to turn out so that they comprise 30% of the electorate, so that they actually sort of comprise what their proportions are in the electorate. And then you need 30% of whites in order to be able to win. So, you know, that's the numerical game. So if you think 90% of 30%, and then you add that with 30% of about 70%, I'm not going to do the arithmetic in my head, but that's probably going to put you over to 50% plus one or somewhere in that ballpark. That happened in the presidential election. So the weighting on the exit poll shifts, but the last time I looked, they were estimating that Joe Biden got about 30% of the white vote. And that, you know, that's part of the sort of reasoning and logic behind that. But as Georgia's non-white population grows, you may need to rely less on liberal whites in order to get to 50% plus one. So one of the other things that the exit polls showed was that turnout amongst Latino and Asian American voters was very, very robust. So those were being weighted actually above their proportions in the population. And if these groups, they're not 90% Democratic, but if they were voting, you know, in the 60 to 70% Democratic range, that could actually help offset any deficiencies that one might have in, amongst the white vote, but then also if African-American turnout proves to be lackluster.
So yeah, and of course, there's a lot of focus at the moment on the ways in which the Republican Party in Georgia is tearing itself apart. But I've traveled around the Midwest and I've looked at this a lot. Biden's coalition is shaky as well. I mean, there are very different interests, beliefs, political positions in the, as there always are in coalitions mm-hmm. that elect presidents or elect parties. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the big debates, as you touched on, is how much do the Democrats in states like Georgia need centrist, moderate, typically white Democrats, or whether or not building the multiracial coalition involves more progressive positions. So mm-hmm. be interesting for you to paint that picture as best you can.
So, you know, usually because we have a two-party system, we don't have proportional representation or parliamentary system. Our two major parties have been big tents. That was certainly the case in the mid part of the 20th century. And what we've seen happen in the last 50 years is that we've seen greater polarization. And a lot of that polarization has to do with the fact that those big tents have shuffled. And so we've seen this thing we call ideological sorting take place. So once upon a time, there used to be liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats. So, you know, these people who we talk about in terms of their issues of race also represented certain ideological positions. And what that meant were that there were people who, when we think about the entire sort of chamber and the entire sort of two-party spectrum in the United States, we used to have a lot of centrists. So people like Sam Nunn, for instance, people like Zell Miller would have been considered centrist Democrats when they were Democrats, you know, particularly thinking about Zell Miller, who changed his party affiliation, or at least, you know, who he was hanging out with towards the end of his life. These people today might not necessarily be Democrats. So people who were conservative Democrats would be probably more likely to be Republican today. And people who are liberal Republicans would be more likely to be Democrats today. And so what that means is that with the center disappearing, we've seen people who are on the farther ends of the ideological perspective getting greater voice. And in terms of party politics, and so there's certainly been a debate about outreach and about whether or not Democrats need to reach out in particular to working class white voters who have been increasingly elusive in the party coalition. And so in certain parts of the country, yeah, you still do. But in general, it's important to kind of keep in mind that working class whites started voting Republican well before 2016. And so the idea of trying to go back and court a group that is more clearly Republican in its orientation than Democratic is certainly something worth considering. But ideological sorting is actually mediated amongst people of color. So the perceptions of racism between the two parties largely keep Democrats of color out of the Republican Party if they're conservative. So when we talk about moderating forces within the Democratic Party, particularly in the South, those moderating forces aren't necessarily those college-educated suburban white folks that people talked a lot about, right? We have to go back to thinking about the primaries and thinking about sort of who were the moderates. And the moderates there were African Americans. And their version of moderation might look a little bit different than it does for white moderates. Sometimes it could be characterized by just pragmatism about sort of who is electable. And so, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody opposes, you know, Bernie Sanders' proposals for minimum wage or for healthcare. But if you think that Bernie Sanders is unelectable in a general election, you might actually decide that it would be more prudent to take to support the more, you know, the more moderate candidate. It's also important to understand sort of like, you know, what moderate issues are the ones that are actually most salient in helping people make their decisions. So the ideological debate is still there. People of color are actually very centered in those kinds of debates. And it's important for us to recognize that they're still there. So when, you know, one of the things that's actually different about Georgia politics is whether or not you, you know, how much you should appeal to white moderates in the state or maybe even more conservative folks in the state, but also do you shy away from national issues? And so as we've seen our politics become more polarized, they've become more nationalized. And so it's not a liability for a Democrat in Georgia anymore to, you know, fully embrace the Democratic Party platform. You know, in ways that they may have shied away from it. So oftentimes, you know, the way my friends who are political reporters talk about it is, you know, you don't get those pro Second Amendment Republican light Democrats anymore. Like that may have fallen out of favor, even though there's still a really important cadre of moderate Democrats who are more diverse than I think people give them credit for. And where you might see evidence of that moderation might be in terms of a discussion about defunding the police. So people who are very supportive of police reform might actually be in supportive of, you know, diverting funds away from the police towards other social services so that the police aren't being responsible to do things that they're not trained to do, but would not go so far as to sort of entertain the idea of fully defunding the police. So like, so you will see places where people are going to have that discussion. And sometimes it is born out of a true ideological conviction. And sometimes it's, and part of it is also just pure pragmatism, like what's actually possible in this particular moment that's going to help advance a particular goal.
Yeah. And on that, it's interesting. A lot of my reporting around the election and before the election was focused on the Black Lives Matter movement and how it was both an energizing and mobilizing force in many communities and had a polarizing and dividing effect on others. And many of the people I met who were going to vote for Trump cited it as their kind of number one issue. So I'd love to hear you paint the picture of how that movement has been a dynamic for Georgia this year.
So I'm off the top of my head, I can't remember what the numbers are, but nationally, the exit polls did ask questions about perceptions of policing, perceptions of Black Lives Matter. And so perhaps not surprisingly, people who were supportive of Black Lives Matter overwhelmingly supported Joe Biden. Those who didn't overwhelmingly supported Donald Trump. And, you know, it fit larger narratives about the perceptions of the two parties on issues related to race. So 55 years ago, the concern would have been, you know, who's going to be pro the Civil Rights Act, pro the Voting Rights Act, right? Today, it's going to be, are you kind of, you know, pro addressing these issues, recognizing that Blacks are treated differently by police, you know, or are you going to be more receptive to the law and order message, which has its roots in Nixon's Southern strategy and dog whistle appeals to whites who, you know, were uncomfortable with the pace of civil rights. So, you know, I think that there's a lot that's kind of undergirding it. And Donald Trump has, you know, for two election cycles was able to very effectively tap into that anger and that sense of grievance amongst some, definitely not all whites. But yeah, even amongst people who are sympathetic of Black Lives Matter and understand that racism is a problem in policing and want to do something to address racial justice, there's still a ton of heterogeneity in terms of, well, what do we do to sort of ameliorate the problem? I mean, and even within Black Lives Matter, there isn't a consensus about, you know, what to do, or, you know, even a consensus about sort of what one's version of defund the police is. And I think we have to acknowledge that nuance and actually sit and have detailed and complex discussions about things, as opposed to trying to reduce things down to sound bites and try to say that people are necessarily saying things that they don't say. And we can have the marketing argument about whether or not the slogan is actually the right slogan. But the truth is, defund the police means lots of different things, and it doesn't mean anarchy. Oftentimes, like, there are people who are trying to take advantage of the simplicity of the slogan to make claims that just are not borne out by experience, aren't borne out by people's platforms and other things that they've said that would demonstrate otherwise.
Thank you. Yeah. And I wanted to just talk finally about the Democratic candidates. Give me the Georgia context on both of them, because I think that's just painting a picture for listeners about who these people are, what they're offering, why they may appeal, where and how they may fall short.
The Democrats have two relatively novice candidates running for this election. So John Ossoff was better known. He had interned, I believe, for John Lewis. At one point, he's a documentary film maker by occupation, and he ran unsuccessfully to replace Tom Price in the Georgia 6th Congressional District in 2017. It was up until that point the most expensive congressional race in U.S. history, and it was, again, one of those races where there wasn't much else going on electorally in the United States at the time period. It got a lot of attention. He proved to be a very adept fundraiser. Tom Price had replaced Newt Gingrich in Congress, you know, had left to become Health and Human Services Secretary. So there was a lot of pent-up demand for the seat. So you get a race where there are a couple dozen people trying to run for this particular office. Ossoff quickly consolidated the Democratic support in the district. And then there were a lot of Republicans who were running for the seat. Karen Handel emerged as the Democratic contender who ran against Ossoff ultimately, and she was able to narrowly win, but not before tens of millions of dollars were raised. There was tons of advertising going on in Metro Atlanta. And basically what we saw Ossoff do was mobilize what seemed like every potential Democratic vote in the district at that time. He just fell slightly short. And so the takeaway was Ossoff did the absolute best that he possibly could to get anybody out to vote who could have possibly voted. It's just that at the time, there were probably slightly more Republicans than there were Democrats in the state. The tide turned 2 years later, and Lucy McBath was able to win the Democratic nomination. And then she was able to beat Karen Handel, reflecting the demographic changes in the district. So, you know, we've seen that shift happen. So, you know, Ossoff got a lot of national exposure from running that race. And so that put him, and he's a really, really strong fundraiser. And he was able to use that to beat two other well-known Democratic candidate, Sarah Riggs Amico, who had been Stacey Abrams' running mate in 2018, and then Teresa Tomlinson, the former mayor of Columbus, Georgia, to win the Democratic nomination for the Purdue seat. Raphael Warnock sort of emerged. It took a while as the leading Democratic candidate in another multi-candidate field that was running in the open primary to replace Johnny Isaacson permanently. And Warnock sort of brings a different cachet to the table. So he's the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is Martin Luther King's home church. As the pastor of what they call America's Freedom Church, he was very social justice oriented and, you know, hadn't been afraid to, one, be involved in the community, to be involved in social justice protests, to be arrested for causes he believed in. He wasn't well known everywhere. He's from Savannah, so he's able to take advantage of being from another part of the state, and then, you know, has been able to use his cachet of being pastor of Ebenezer to at least help to build his name identification. He consolidated his support after he won key endorsements from people like Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama. He had long had the support of Stacey Abrams, and so people had had him pegged of being the potential Democratic frontrunner in the race. And so, you know, he pretty much coasted to a first place victory in the open primary, but you have to get a clear majority of the vote in order to win outright in Georgia. Otherwise, you have to go to runoffs, which is how we ended up in this place to begin with. And just given the sheer number of people in the race, nobody expected him, or anybody for that matter, to get 50% plus one. The Republicans were prevented in actually being able to do that, because after Kelly Loeffler, who was the interim senator who was appointed by Governor Kemp to replace Senator Isaacson, announced her candidacy, Doug Collins, who had also been considered but hadn't been chosen to be appointed to the seat, chose to run. And he actually tried to run on the sort of idea that he was actually Trump's first choice. And so Brian Kemp appointed Kelly Loeffler kind of over the objections of President Trump. And so you see this fight between Collins and Loeffler. Loeffler ended up winning that fight by coming in second place. And so that's how she, ended up on the ballot challenging him.
What's your view on how strong they are as candidates, given the realities? Are they the sort of the best candidates the Democrats could put forward? You know, if any Democrats are going to win these races, are these the people? Like, what is your sense of like strengths and weaknesses in terms of the offer?
So, this race has largely been national. So there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion of Georgia's specific issues. And both the Democrats and the Republicans have actually been pretty content to talk about this in national terms. So John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock have been portrayed as radical leftist socialists by the Republicans. It is pretty common to see Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Bernie Sanders show up in their ads. And the Democrats have tried to paint the Republicans as being rich, out of touch, and corrupt. And in particular, there's been a lot of focus on the stock trades that both Senators Loeffler and Perdue engaged in around the time that we were learning more about COVID-19. And they've been trying to portray them as being more concerned about their own wealth than they were about the safety and welfare of Georgians, you know, who were getting ready to enter this awful pandemic period. And, you know, the senators have talked a little bit about their records, but in particular, with the exception of, you know, Senator Perdue, who's been serving for 6 years, Senator Loeffler, Reverend Warnock, John Ossoff, you know, are all relatively new politicians. You know, up until last year, none of them had held political office before. And so, you know, we are actually watching novice politicians at play, particularly in the special Senate race. Senator Loeffler's attacks against Reverend Warnock have been interesting, to say the least. I use that term a little sarcastically. One, she instantly went on the attack. It was actually a couple of weeks before we saw anything that could have been construed as a positive political ad for her on the airwaves. She immediately went on the offensive on Reverend Warnock, and she immediately went to issues that were highly racialized. So she started running ads that talked about Jeremiah Wright's connections, to Raphael Warnock. So reminding people of that speech that almost upended Barack Obama's candidacy in 2008, and then, you know, noted that Warnock had supported Wright publicly. It even helped to give him an award for truth telling. And in doing so, she has made an issue of Reverend Warnock's social justice sermons. And, you know, she has taken him to task for, you know, in one sermon saying that you can't serve God and the military. She has suggested that he is anti-Israel. She has taken issue with the fact that when he was a youth pastor, his church had invited Fidel Castro to speak, suggesting that, you know, he had something to do with it. And, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners go to church, but I do. And the youth pastor is usually not the ringleader of any kind of event like that. Like the youth pastor is not the one in charge, like at all. So yeah, so I mean, these characterizations are highly charged and they are calling Black liberation theology into account. And so, you know, this is a not uncommon theological tenet in African-American churches where Black Christians, you know, have used Christianity, you know, not just for their own personal salvation, but they've used this to undergird and to justify their social actions on behalf of freedom for other folks. And so she's waded in a territory that, you know, has certainly been interesting. You know, we question sort of what the motives behind it. I would still have to do some message testing to see where this resonates. I don't think that anybody's actually really trying to persuade new people to come along. I think that it's mainly to try to drive up turnout, you know, amongst their own bases and to keep them encouraged. But if, you know, the Republicans were concerned at all that there were Republicans in the state who skipped the presidential election or who perhaps voted for Joe Biden, one, they should note that those folks then, if they voted down ballot, probably, we're not 100% sure yet, but we think voted Republican in the Senate race. So I don't think they had anything to worry about per se with that. But just in case, maybe this would be something to try to tell those conflicted Republican voters that Raphael Warnock isn't the genial pastor that you think he is. He actually is espousing this theology that's foreign to you. And so that, like, that might be a ploy towards particularly white evangelicals. But, you know, my point is they were already going to vote Republican. And so I don't know that you necessarily needed to go in this particular direction in order to keep them in the fold. It just raises all of these other questions about race baiting that, you know, I'm not sure that they really wanted to answer. So, you know, this is, I think that, like, you know, these attacks are actually more about driving up turnout amongst their side's base versus, you know, and trying to demobilize or discourage support on the other side. The problem is that when you attack the Black church, there is nothing that African-American voters who are familiar with the church would see in those sermonettes and in those sermon clips that would be foreign to them. So even if they disagree theologically, I just don't think it has the same type of demobilizing effect because one, those ads look like they're being taken out of context anyway. And two, I think people, you know, who are familiar and care about it, understand what Warnock was trying to say. And even people who are not necessarily religious wouldn't necessarily be thrown by those particular messages.
Yeah, you've been but delicate or elegant around this issue of race baiting, right? Or dog whistling or what these ads clearly seem to be to me from a distance, right?
Yeah.
And it would be great to explain that. So for example, our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, once, you know, peddled the nonsense about Barack Obama having a thing against Britain because the British had tortured his grandfather, you know, during the Mau Mau uprising. And of course, that's just, everyone saw that for what it was, just a dog whistle, right?
Right.
And so fill us in on some of what dog whistling is, you know, and mm-hmm. you've used a couple of examples, but you've been a bit delicate about it.
Yeah.
Like, really, really paint that picture.
We know that there's public opinion data that suggests that Americans are more comfortable with the idea of Blacks protesting than protest overall, suggesting that African-Americans are not perceived as being, you know, legitimate people who are in a position to critique America. And that's something that we still have to grapple with. So when Kelly Loeffler wants to associate Raphael Warnock with a sermon that was given by Barack Obama's pastor, where he was critiquing America in a very provocative way, she's tapping into that type of resentment and in that perception that Blacks are out of place when they critique America. And she might want to try to hide behind the provocative language that on the surface appeared like it was taking the Lord's name in vain. But one, it wasn't. And two, even back then when it was being used against Barack Obama to try to torpedo his presidential bid, right? It was being used to try to say that Barack Obama went to this church with this scary Black nationalist preacher who was preaching revolution. And so what's, the difference this time around is not that Raphael Warnock goes to a church with a fiery Black preacher. It's he is the fiery Black preacher. Do you want Jeremiah Wright in your, in the US Senate? So there are many, many layers of complexity there, but the racial undertones are unmistakable.
Thank you so much. You have been fantastic. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review. Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.